Welcome to the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. I am incredibly amped for this episode. We love paying homage to all the OGs on both sides of the law. And this is one of the great, true mob, you know, one of the greatest mob busters on the East Coast throughout the 70s, late 70s, 80s, into the 90s. Worked a lot of cases in Connecticut. Donnie Brutnell, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And we're going to tell his story. So, Donnie, before we jump into Connecticut, just to give my hometown Detroiters some love. Donnie got to Connecticut in the late 70s, he started in Indianapolis and then made his way to Detroit. At a time where there was a lot going on, the Jackalone brothers, Jimmy Hoffa, a changeover in leadership between the the old school Zerilli and Toko to the new school Zerilli and Toko. Donnie, what were your impressions of the Detroit crime family in the city in the 70s?
It was amazing. When I had worked for a fugitive squad in Indianapolis 3 years, first office agent and stuff, got to Detroit. And when I got to Detroit, I can go on, but here's the story. I got to Detroit. Neil J. Welch was the SAC in Detroit at that time, and known as probably the toughest SAC, but the fairest and the best in the FBI. I went in for my interview as I came into Detroit, and he was sitting there behind the desk with a newspaper up, and I couldn't see him. And he says, "Tell me about yourself." I mean, tell me about. So I told him, I went to high school such and such. And he goes, "You're boring me." I went, "Oh, man, this is not a good start." So he says, "Get out, go see my secretary." I went, "Whoa." So I go outside. Secretary Mary was an ex-Marine sergeant. So she goes, would you like a cup of coffee? And I said, "Oh, I sure would." She goes, "I'll take cream and sugar." And I went, "Excuse me?" And she goes, "You think I'm going to go get your coffee?" I go, right. I said, "Whoa." So anyway, she says,
"This is Detroit, though. Isn't this, the experience that you just relayed to us is like Detroit is a tough as nails town. They're going to go get your own coffee."
It wasn't like Indianapolis, I'll tell you that. So anyway, within a couple of minutes, a guy came down, the supervisor told me, "Get rid of the tie, get rid of the sport coat, go downstairs, you'll see a tan Chevrolet pick you up in the corner, tell you what's going on, see you, you're on my squad, now you're going to be working organized crime." And that's exactly what happened. So I went out, took my shirt off, got in the car, went around the block with this guy, and he's filling me in. He said, "We've got a major investigation going on against the Detroit Police Department. There's some corrupt police officers. We've been working for a while. You're going into a bar. You're to go in with me. Just be relaxed, have beers, have a sandwich. Maybe we'll shoot some pool. And pay attention to this section of the bar because we think that's where the payoffs are going to be going down. Identifying, blah, blah, blah." And I'm going, this is unbelievable. So I go in there, and of course we did. We drank, had a few. It was the Anchor Bar, the name of it.
Yeah, that's a famous bar that's still around, I think. And it was a big hangout for mob guys, police officers, newspaper people, judges, lawyers.
That's the place. So we did. I spent all afternoon in there. And you got to remember, this is 1970 or something. And the marching orders from Hoover were, no agent drinks on duty. And I'm thinking, well, somebody told me to drink on duty, so I guess I keep drinking. By the time I got home, man, I lit up pretty good. And my wife was saying, "What the hell is going on here?" And I said, "Welcome to Detroit. I like this job. And I said, "Man," and it took, the next day they kind of debriefed and we went through. But that was my start. From that point on, I was working organized crime pretty much my whole career. In Detroit, I got moved to the surveillance squad, which again was an innovation created by Neil Welch out of Buffalo office. He started it up there, and he moved his, when he came to Detroit, brought that whole concept with him. So we had an off-site, you know, surveillance team. Dress as you want, you know, hair, whatever you want to do, just get the job done. And yeah, so that was how I got into organized crime. And like I said, I worked it the whole time I was in Detroit. And again, the names you've mentioned, Scott, Zerilli was the power then, the old man and the kid. And then the Tocos, of course, and stuff. But my focus and a lot of our focus was on the Jackalones, and whether it be Tony or Billy, and, you know, concentrating on them. And I had developed a couple of sources, you know, to get closer to them. So a lot of surveillances on them, a lot of going to Greek town, going because they use the Greek muscle down there, the Katronises and stuff.
Yep.
And it was just a lot of hours, a lot of work. And step back a little bit. The Omnibus Crime Bill had come in 1968, which gave, you know, the Title III authority. So now you're talking 71, 72. This is relatively new, but already the Bureau was into it at the anchor bar to be, you know, included.
Yep.
And, you know, so it was just one Title III after another, surveillance backing up the Title III. So I got to know the state of Michigan pretty quickly. It was good. It was a great time.
So did those trips to Anchor Bar and the wiretaps, is that what I think it was, which was there was a bust in 1971, I believe.
The big one?
That stemmed out of Anchor Bar. There was actually a tie to my family, and a subsequent murder. One of the people that got busted there was Sally Schindel.
I remember that name.
Yeah, so Sally was the one that was that. Him and Chickie Sherman and Ronnie Morelli and Bobby LaPuma.
Bobby LaPuma, yeah.
Yeah, these were the guys that were at the Anchor Bar. And then less than a year later, Sally ended up dead because they thought he was going to talk.
Huh. Rip Curry.
That's it's my aunt's brother.
Oh, okay.
This is way before I was born.
Yeah.
But I always heard stories about Sly. So can you tell us maybe a little bit about the Jackalones and those guys that I just mentioned were Jackalone lieutenants, Bobby, Ronnie.
Yeah, and what happened on the Anchor Bar, you know, is the big case. We took down a number of police officers for taking bribes. I mean, the surveillance was it's in the, on the other side of the wall with a hole punched in the wall with the camera going in the wall, watching the activity at the bar and seeing payoffs being put in the back pocket of different police officers and stuff like that, had them cold, right? And then when it came to push the shove, all the attorneys got involved and all the arrests had gone down. The thing was kicked out because it was not, the law said it had to be signed by the Attorney General of the United States, okay? And I forgot the exact reason, but he did not sign it. The second in command signed it. They threw the whole thing out. The whole thing was gone. All those cops that take the money and everything, that was it. They got off, you know? But it was, that was awful. But that's what happened because it had not been signed by the Attorney General personally. So the Title III was out.
You know? You were following around. I know you were following around Billy Jackalone. And I know that you were one of the people that got him on one of his kind of famous cases where you found a gun in a secret compartment in the car. Back then, now the secret compartment shtick is something that's been kind of tried and true, but 50 years ago it was a little unique. Tell us about
it was, and he had a source who was a good source, obviously, and advised that he was driving around. He had a gun in the car. Everyone's afraid of Billy Jackalone, by the way. Billy Jackalone and Tony were not nice people, and the fear of them on the street was unbelievable. But then to know that he had a gun right there in the car. So we got a search warrant for the car. Supposedly had a button within the dash. All he had to do was hit the button. It would pop down to 38, would be there. So we got the warrant. And I remember when they were in the car, searching the car, couldn't find any button. Now I'm not feeling too good about this search warrant, right? And all of a sudden, one of the techs found a thing, hit it. Down came the tray. In the tray was the gun. We got him. We got him.
I'm pretty sure I have a picture of that in my first book, Motor City Mafia, shameless plug. Pretty sure I have a photo from the FBI that I got.
Oh,
from
really?
That exact bust. Yeah, with a photo of the compartment and yeah.
Yeah.
I'll send it to you when we're done here.
Oh, I'd love it. And then the thing of it is, then I had to go to court and justify the warrant. And of course we didn't want to give up the source. And that was a different experience with a top mob attorney as a young agent sitting there being grilled. Oof. We got through it. And bye-bye, Billy.
Yeah, he had to go do some time. Before we move to Connecticut, one more. We can't leave Detroit without mentioning Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah.
What's your recollections of that? And then and then I'll ask you the final question will be, what do you think happened to him? And
yeah.
But start with just what the case coming to be.
Again, with all the leads popping out of the interviews that were being done by the case agents then, necessitated a lot of surveillances. So we were doing surveillance on different characters, whether it be the Teamster people, whether it be some of the mob guys. And of course, where is he? And just following people here and there and trying to put the lead information coming from the case agents to a surveillance where we could definitively get a great outcome. Dealt with Teamsters, dealt with everybody, dealt with the family, Jimmy Jr., dealt with Mrs. Hoffa, dealt with his daughter, you know, and it was obviously a very involved case, and did a lot of surveillances on the Giacalone people. And again, obviously we did not get the conclusion we wanted. But a lot of work. And my impression, where is he? You know, I'm still of the belief, well, he didn't leave Michigan.
Right. I think all due respect to Dan Moldea, who I have I can't even put into words how much respect I have for the work that he's done. But I really believe anybody that really knows that he never left Detroit. Go ahead.
Did not leave. No way. Who's going to transport a body in any shape, form, or whatever, take a chance to get caught? But there's right in the area there, some of these names I can't remember. It may have been a Vitale. I'm not sure. He had a home not too far away from the Marcus Red Fox.
It was Carlo Licata.
Okay. There you go. And I think he could have gone there for a meeting to resolve some issues between the Giacalones and Tony Provenzano and all these guys and, you know, under that guise. And again, he didn't have his bodyguards with him because he's meeting his son and he didn't need the bodyguards for him. But they went there, popped him, I think, obviously. And then I think he went to the incinerator. That's where I think he went.
Which was owned by Vitale.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Corrado and Jimmy Quazzarano.
Yep. And I think they took care of it right there. Very quick, neat, done. A lot of talk. They were doing the pilings for the Renaissance Center at that time. And a lot of thing was that they threw them down the piling, you know. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there's a thousand ways it could have happened. That's only my estimation what happened, you know.
All right, so let's bring you to New Haven. I know we skipped over Syracuse, but let's just go right to New Haven. When did you get there?
I got to New Haven, probably 19. Well, I was going back and forth on the Syracuse case, but probably 1979, I was entrenched there, feet on the ground and doing stuff.
And there was obviously, you know, quite a bit of activity percolating there between the Genovese, the Gambinos, the Colombos, I believe, also, and the Patriarchos.
Yeah, and believe it or not, Scott, there's another family working out of the New Britain area, DiCavalcante.
Right, the Buff Brothers.
Yeah, well, they had the main guy was Pippi Guerrero.
Pippi Guerrero, and then right, the LaSalle Brothers.
But You're right. When I got there, it was so fractionalized. You had Whitey Tropiano with the Columbus. You had the influence of Raymond Patriarch and the New England people. And then you had the Genovese, wherever you, and they had some New Haven, they had some Bridgeport, they, you know, and then Bridgeport was the Gambino headquarters, really, and Stanford. They had Fairfield County, okay?
Right.
So I'm thinking, wow, there's all these families here, and if, yeah, they were getting along. I mean, they were doing all right. But primarily, you had Billy Grasso was up and coming, and he really became up and coming after Whitey Tropiano got popped. Once they took Whitey out, and that was at the behest of Raymond Patriarca in them, you know, they took him out. Billy elevated himself major league. So you got, there goes the, that influence of the Tropianos. And then
was Tropiano, what city was he out of?
He was pretty much East Haven.
East Haven, okay.
You know, he had a diner right there in East Haven, in that area. And again, we're talking gambling, loan sharking. In those days, the football slips. Football slips were huge, right? But it was all, everything seemed to be gambling. The money was coming from gambling for the most part, right? And in New Haven, one of the prominent figures, the Genovese guy, was a guy named Salvatore Nunziato, who was Midgey Renault.
Midgey, right.
Midgey Renault was a former boxer, you know, tough. He was a tough guy. And he had control of the New Haven gambling and all that kind of stuff. Although Genovese people in Bridgeport were in charge of the football slips. So they, you know, they brought them into New Haven. There's a lot of money in that. And then in Bridgeport, we'll stick with Genovese. In Bridgeport, it was the Curcios, Fat Franny, his brother Vinny, and then, of course, Gus, right? They were the Genovese guys down there. And they had a number of other people, some guys in West Haven, blah, blah. And then if you move to the Bridgeport Gambinos, then you're talking Frank Piccolo, who was a capo, you know, in the Gambino family. And then he had Nick Patty up in the valley doing gambling. He had people in West Haven, too, doing some gambling. But he was the man. And Tommy DeBreezy, he was in a Bridgeport area. Then down in Fairfield County, Stanford, with the Gambinos, you had Cosmo Sandalo.
Right.
An up-and-comer, Tony McGeely. And they were all accountable to New York.
I didn't realize until recently that Cosmo was Tony McGailey's uncle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he was the older statesman for right. them down there. And he took, what's his name, McGailey under his wing. And then, of course, McGailey got tied up with drugs and stuff. And that didn't set well, you know. But, yeah, it just showed you from one end of the state to the other, there was mob control but different families. It was amazing. It was amazing. And of course, Piccolo got popped. And that was, we believe it was all on Neil Delacroce and Paul Castellano's decision. This was before your time, but Frankie Piccolo was Flamboyant Frank, man. The clothes, he was the movie guy. He was right out of the movies, right? And he
spent a lot of time out in L.A. too. Movie stars, yeah.
Yep, and with what's the name of the singer?
Guido Panisi was his cousin, yep. Or his cousin, and had him out there. They were feeding. I'm guessing you know they were feeding cocaine to all of the ABC Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley.
I didn't know that. Yeah,
Piccolo and Panosi were feeding the entire ABC studio set with cocaine.
That was that. And then, he was buddies with Wayne Newton, you know, and that thing. But Piccolo was too flamboyant. We had wiretaps on him going on, and everyone's afraid he was going to roll. And, you know, that he's not a prison type of guy, you know. And everyone, New York was afraid he was going to flip it. And I think that was the main reason that he got taken out. And they gave that assignment to Genovese.
And wouldn't that be kind of, I mean, from my reporting, that was kind of controversial that they wouldn't do their own house cleaning and that they let the Genovese, the allegedly the Curcios and the Hells Angels.
Took him out. Yeah, that was, you know, and matter of fact, you know, a guy, John Gotti, from our information, was really pissed that the Genovese took out a capo. He was really pissed. And there was a lot of infighting over that decision. Again, Gotti and looking at Paulie Castellano, you know, and Neil Delacroce. So there was that animosity there. But yeah, that didn't sit well at all, not at all. And then right after that, the individual who thought he was going to take Frank's place, Tommy DeBreeze, they popped him. And he got found in a trunk in a parking lot in Trumbull, Connecticut.
There's that famous soundbite from John Gotti where he says, the only reason he's dying is because he didn't come and see me. That's it. He did nothing else wrong. Kind of a famous.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was, now they're gone. The power of the Gambinos is Bridgeport gone, right? And now Curcio's. And of course, New York supporting Gambino. Curcio's take over, and now they got Bridgeport and whatever they want in there, you know. So we had a lot of stuff going on, a lot of Title Threes, a lot of surveillances, a lot of interviews. Be honest with you, it was fun times, you know.
Can you tell the, if you can, or if you're willing to, can you talk about impressions of, I know Fat Franny was a larger than life, literally and figuratively. But he's been gone for a while. Gussie is still around. Can you tell what were your impressions of Gussie, particularly as a younger wise guy?
Smart. He was smarter than Fat Franny and well, Vinny was a bondsman. But yeah, he was smarter. Cagier, he also had a number of businesses out there. He had pawn shops. He had
still does
topless bars.
Still does. Had,
huh?
He still does.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's a businessman. He even got into the garbage business for a while, you know. But, yeah, so he was one of these guys that knew how to cover his tracks. He used the Hells Angels, you know, and he used them to whack, you know. We're convinced it was
we can just say allegedly. It's not a secret what the feds believed that who took out Piccolo. Gus was charged.
Gus did.
And Diamond Dan Byfield, who was the head of the Hells Angels, was implicated as one of the shooters. Wasn't charged. He recently died. I don't know if you know that. He died a couple weeks ago.
Danny Byfield
died in a.
He was a vicious guy.
Yeah, was a suspect in quite a few murders.
He's a vicious guy. Well, you know, the Hells Angels, there was another guy who was a Genovese guy, Tommy the Blonde Vestano,
mm-hmm.
out of Stratford, and he got popped at his doorstep. And that had to be in the 80s, I guess, 70s.
Yeah, early. I think it was early 80s.
And again, the problem with him. Convinced the bikers did him for Gus and Franny, right? Didn't get proved, but that was the. But he, Tommy the Blonde was older, shaky. He had gotten grand jury subpoena. He had gone to grand jury, and he was weak, as they thought, and they were afraid he was going to spill his guts. So he's also the guy that got Midgey Renault to come out that night and get in the ride in car and take a ride, Tommy the Blonde. So he knew all about the murder of Midgey. So there's a lot of knowledge there on the part of Tommy the Blonde that with him talking have been devastating to people. So, but, you know, bye-bye, Tommy.
Also kind of a common thing? Like, from what I understand, DeBreeze set Piccolo up. Guy that made the phone call to get him into the phone booth.
Always thought that Scott always thought it, that he made the call and said, you're going to get a call from New York. They want to settle things here. Bing, bing, yep. And that's where they knocked him out of the phone booth, you know?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the rise of Billy Grasso. And that must have been, that wasn't New York, but that was quite the fireworks display in the late 80s with him rising to power, becoming the underboss, killing a bunch of people on his own, and then getting killed by his own by his own people in the middle of a war.
Right. Billy started being in prison with Raymond Patriarca, right? As we used to say, he was polishing his shoes. And then they made that contact, and then we were convinced he set up the hit on Whitey Tropiano. There's a famous photo. We introduced it in our trial, I think, but it's a photo, New York City in the rain, Billy Grasso holding an umbrella over Tony Salerno's head as they're walking down the street, right? So now you're putting New England family, Patriarca, holding the umbrella for the big Genovese guy, right? So that tie right there, the Genovese and them were getting along, the Patriarchas. So, but Billy, he became real powerful after Whitey went with all the gambling and all the kind of stuff and stuff. And when he really got, there's so much going on here, the really exploded for Billy is there was Boston, I'm jumping way ahead now, but Boston in the late 80s was making a move with this guy Russo and getting their power base. Billy wanted his, he had to get an army down in Connecticut because he's afraid of them. They're afraid of him. And that's when tried to take out Frankie Cadillac Salemi and Grasso at the same time. But always assumed that Billy's power came from the fact that there was a guy, and I believe Scott, his name is Johnny Vitano. It's going back a while. He's deceased now. He died of cancer. But I think he was a part of the hit on Piccolo with Curcio. Okay. Somehow he has something to do with that. Anyway, the Genovese books were closed. No new members. So Billy, trying to build his army, he has a meeting out at this guy Billy Grant's place out in Madison.
Hot dog Billy Grant.
Yeah, or Westbrook, I guess, yeah, to make his army. So they had
induction ceremony.
Induction ceremony for like seven guys. And what Billy did, he brought Vitano in, became a made guy as a favor to the Genovese because their books were closed. That gave him all he needed to get along with Springfield, New York, everything. You know, do what you want, Billy. Connecticut's yours. You got that. Take it. And he did. He did take it. So they had the making ceremony. And then, we're jumping right ahead. I mean, that's the one where Gaetano Milano was the guys under Billy. It's hard to... For people, the guys under Billy, closest people, anybody was terrified that he'd get pissed off one day and kill you.
Right.
I mean, crazy man. They call him crazy guy. And they were, so everyone had that on their mind. If I fuck up, I'm gone. Right. So when Russo said, we got to take him out, told Gaetano, you get him done or we'll take you out. You know, so not many options at that point. So that Gaetano, is the guy that shot him. They had Louis Pugliano driving the van. You talk about a mess. I mean, you talk about the gang that couldn't shoot straight. It was pathetic. It was unbelievable. They had a backup car that was supposed to pop Billy, drive down to the Connecticut River in this area, drive down this road, throw the body out, the backup car come in, pick up the body, get rid of the body, put it in the river and do whatever you got to do, right? Well, they got lost. They missed. Where'd they go? Right. That's Sonny Castagna. So they, here goes the van now. They're driving up 91 at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. 1 o'clock. Billy sitting in the driver's, in the passenger seat. Louis Pugs driving. Gaetano getting his ass chewed by Billy in the ride for screwing up with bookmaking, just chewing his ass out, right? And they're going up there. So finally, he just slides down, picks up the gun. In the middle of the day, 91 North, he pops him right behind the ear. Now, that could have blown blood all over the windshield, could have, whatever. I mean, right? The bullet just, you know, really no blood, no nothing. Jackie Johns was in the van, grabbed Billy by the hair, pulled him back like he's sitting upright in the car. They continue up, do a U-turn up in Hartford, come down 91, go over, throw the body out, thinking the backup's there, and off they go. It was just gang that couldn't shoot straight. But Billy's dead, and everyone's pretty happy.
Could you talk a little bit, if you know, about Billy's killed in summer of 89, June of 89.
Yep.
But there were a couple murders of guys around him in the year or two leading up to this. Yep. And if you have any insight, we'd love to hear it.
Oh, yeah.
Hot Dog Grant, who we just talked about before.
He died. Well, he was killed in May of 88.
He was and, his kid had a college graduation party or something and didn't show up.
And Billy was, Billy had a name, East Side, West Side, you know, on the east side of Hartford where he lived. And he was like, you know, the little league coach, the go to church type thing with the family guy.
And he owned the famous hot dog place, right?
Augie and Ray's. And then on the other side, he was the mob guy. You know, cross the river, get the west side of night, he's mob stop Billy. And he was a tough guy. He ran the gambling over there. And, but he also had been, like Grosso, he got the responsibility of taking care of Persico.
Alley boy.
Yeah. He hid out in West Hartford for years, right? And so Billy was the conduit, Grant, to get him the money from New York to Bobby Grosso, Grosso to Grant to Alley Boy. You know, that was his job. Well, a couple of things happened. One, Billy's grand juries were going on, the good old grand juries. Again, these guys don't like the grand juries because I think everybody's giving it up, right? So I had grand juries going on, and at the same time, the Marshal Service did a phenomenal job of tracking through driver's licenses and numbers. They identified him, and they got Persico, right? The Marshals did. Well, Persico thought that Billy, through the grand jury or whatever, had given him up, right? Dimed him. So he had to go. And the guy who was responsible for Billy Grant, Billy Grosso.
Yeah.
Billy Grosso, he takes care of it. And never found
The people thought they might have found him under a house, but they never knew for sure.
In the garage.
Right.
In the garage in Hamden. And that's the other guy we're going to talk about. I am Salvatore Caruana. Salvatore Caruana was out of Rhode Island. He's a big marijuana guy. In those days, that was big money. He's a big marijuana guy. And he was on the lam in Connecticut, same thing. He was, his babysitter was Sal Tequila, Butch Tequila. And he took the money and got the monies and stuff to him from Billy Grosso. Billy Grosso, that same thing, only different families. And what happened, he was a pain in the ass to Grosso. Caruana, Grosso did not like him, didn't want him in his state. But what happens is
Patriarca liked him because he was a big moneymaker.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, Patriarca was dead by that point.
Yep. But Junior and them around and Maddie and stuff. So what happens is Carolina finds out that this guy who's the hockey coach for his kids back home is is banging his wife.
Right.
Teddy Burns, his name was. So that's a no-no. And in the monster thing, you know, you don't mess around with a guy's wife and all that bullshit. So that justified Billy doing what he had to do. Plus, he didn't like him. So they had a setup type thing. And first thing they did is Caruana involves Billy directly with getting rid of Teddy Burns' body. Brings him in the trunk of a car, goes to Billy's house. He says, hey, you got to help me out. I got a body here. Well, you know, so he's, you know, he's going to go sooner or later for doing that. But so that what they did is they got the body, took the body to a garage in New Haven, and it was a dirt garage thing. And they go in there, and they, in this particular one, they had Jackie Johns was there and a couple other people. I forgot who, well, Billy, obviously. Beetle, they owned the house. And they're doing the thing, the digging. And Billy looks up, and he sees Jackie Johns just kind of moving the shovel, you know. And, you better start fucking digging, because if you don't, you're going in there next. Yeah, I mean, just getting the shovel, you know, get the thing out. So in goes Teddy Burns. And when we finally found out where that burial site was, they got three different thyroid bones out of there. I don't know this for a fact, but I assume it's Midge Renault, Sal Caruana, and Grant. That's who I think was in the hole, because there were three bodies in there. And when they dug it up, the main body, you know, the skull, the hip bones and all that were gone. So they knew the heat was on through our investigation. I think they dug them up, got the big parts out, but they still didn't get the digital, you know, the finger type things and the thyroids. Yeah, so it's a lot of shit going on.
Last question about Connecticut.
Yep.
Billy Miller. Do you remember the Billy Miller story? The boxer. Billy.
The what? Oh, Eric Miller.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I'm confused. Eric Miller. I don't know why I said Billy, because we're Billy Grasso, Billy Grant. Sorry.
Too many Billys here.
Eric Miller story.
Yep. And that was the biggest tragedy. And one of the things I can tell you right now, Scott, of things I worked on in the not being able to definitively solve that, just as his father was the nicest man. And actually, Eric was not a bad kid, but. All the stuff's going on. Jackie Johns, Billy, throughout Billy's restaurant, putting plants in, you know. So Eric comes, all he does is go, he's buddies with Jackie Johns, drives by, and he makes the comment that planting flowers, planting trees, that's all you guineas are good for.
Right.
Well, Grasso goes nuts, you know, and starts yelling at Eric Miller, you know. And
they were playing around, right? Like Eric was Irish. Oh, he was an Irish guy. Johns was an Italian guy, and they were joking around. And Billy Grasso was not down with the way they were joking.
Exactly. Oh, there's no exactly what it was. And they're, as they say, fucking around, right? And right. So Billy takes a swing. He's got scissors too, or you know, the clippers there, and he takes a swing at Eric. Well, Eric's a boxer, right? He's a boxer. Defensively, boom, he pops him, and down goes Billy. Knocked him right down. Now, boom. And with that, Sonny Castagna was there, Jackie's father, and Jackie, and they look at Eric and say, you know who this is? You know what you just did? And he goes, what? You know who that guy is? And he didn't. So they tell him, he said, get the hell out of here. He goes. Over the next couple months, Billy says, look, I know this kid's didn't mean it, and you know, he befriends them. They're going to get into renovating apartments together. Billy's going to help them with some money. Everything's going good. New Year's Eve, boom, in a freaking parking lot in Hartford, they put a bunch of, and I, my opinion, Jackie Johns. He brought them there, in effect, right? Right. So it's up to him to do it. And poor Eric didn't do jack, and he got shot for it because of Billy. That's what Billy is like.
I think they had phone records that night of Jackie calling.
Oh yeah, he called his girlfriend.
Not Billy. I keep saying Billy. I'm sorry. Calling Eric. God. Sorry.
It's all over. It was all over drug debt, right? That they set up and stuff. And he told Eric at that point, "Look, we got this. Settle this thing on the debt, the money owes. I'll meet you at such." And it was a call, like you said, in there. Got him out. Went up in the parking lot there, and that's where they shot him.
Well, thank you so much, Donnie. This was awesome. Hopefully we'll bring you back on and we can talk about some more stuff and tell some more war stories.
I'll tell you about our following Piccolo to New York.
Yes, please. And we'll do it maybe sooner than later. If you're down before the holidays.
That's fine. That's fine.
Donnie, thank you so much. Like I said, we pay a debt and owe a debt, I should say. I mean, all this Freudian slips.
Yeah.
We owe a debt to guys like you who put in the work for decades, doing stuff that people only can really understand if they watch movies. Like, people don't get the type of work you do and how much of yourself you have to give.
Well, I'll tell you, your podcast is bringing a lot of it to, out up front, and people hear about it, and you're doing a great job. Like I said, I've listened to them, and I listened to your one on Hoffa and stuff too. And it's very interesting. You do, Scott, not blowing smoke here. You got a lot of knowledge and you use it well.
Thank you. You got to preserve the history, and absolutely, that's what we're doing here. So,
Detroit, you live there now?
I do. I was in Chicago for a decade, and now I'm in Detroit, and we're making a major comeback, man. You should come see the city.
Everyone tells me. Well, I'm watching. See, when I was there, all the sports were downtown.
Right. And now they're back. Now they're back down. Then they left, and now they're back downtown.
And
they
all left. What a difference! I lived in Troy.
Right. I'm 5-10 minutes from Troy. Yeah.
Yeah. We used to call it Hoover Hill.
All the feds were over there.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a Levitt, one of those new Levitt home things.
Yep.
And so there's so many agents there. We called it Hoover Hill.
Well, thank you, Donnie. Thank you, everybody in the audience. These are the kind of interviews that we love giving you. This is an exclusive. Donnie's never really gone on any podcast and told his story, and we're going to be bringing him back. Please like, subscribe, share, spread the word. Scott Bernstein, for Donnie, for Benny behind the glass, OG Pod, we're out.